Hey, thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Visor. My name is Zane Scott with Zane Scott Media. This podcast, we dive in and go into things beyond the racetrack with drivers, crew members, officials, and more. If you like what you hear, we are available on all the podcasting apps, as well as on Facebook at Zane Scott Media. And then you can find us on Instagram as well at Z_S_Media. This episode is brought to you by Zane Scott Media, your one-stop shop for video and more, based out of Casto, Ohio, covering the local Ohio racing scene and beyond. If you're interested in supporting the show or sponsoring the show in any manner, please reach out to me on Facebook, Instagram, X, or by phone number. You can find that on our Facebook page. Hope you guys enjoy this episode, and feel free to reach out to me at any time if you have any questions or you want to be on the show. And thank you for listening, and hope you enjoy. Caleb, what's going on, man? Nice to finally get you on here. I know, a little backstory here, trying to get you on last week, and then TJ and I finished recording super late, and we were kind of like, we want to do this, half asleep or not, so we decided to wait a week, which is kind of better for the sake of the podcast, because we did have the Jim Ford Classic over the weekend, and won two features, came up one spot short Saturday night, so there's going to be, I think, some good material there to talk about, kind of, when we dive into that a little bit, but just like we start every episode, what is the quote that you have for everyone today?
Yeah, I guess it's just kind of one that my dad's always said, is that positive thoughts bring positive outcomes, which I think is a very good one that I try and remind myself of, because I know, you know, you'll kind of have sometimes those mid-season blues of, you know, things aren't maybe going according to plan, or, you know, things kind of upset you, or this or that, but you just got to remind yourself that, you know, if you're positive through it all, that it'll, you know, it's a big thing in mentally. And I think that's one that stuck with me for a long time.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a good one in general. We actually talking about that today at the day job, you know, negative thoughts bring like negative energy, which bring negative results and all of that. And then, you know, when you're upbeat, positive, typically you seem to kind of have more luck fall your way and kind of good things happen. And then once you get the ball rolling on the good things, they kind of keep coming and coming. And then it's a little bit easier to like rebound from a bad negative action or whatever that occurs if you're always, you know, upbeat and positive. So I really like that one. And it's kind of awesome that you brought that up too, because, you know, I just mentioned the Jim Ford. You guys swept first night, you know, double features, you know, positive thoughts going into Saturday. Saturday didn't go quite as you guys liked. It's not a bad finish by any means, second place, but, you know, for $20,000, you know, second sucks any night, but especially on a night like that. How do you keep, you know, those positive thoughts going into next weekend and into a basically double championship style night with Attica on Friday, Fremont on Saturday?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, we know we have a ton of speed, and, going back to back on Friday was a huge confidence booster, and then running second, even so, you know, that's also a huge confidence booster, knowing that we're obviously really, really good right now. And just kind of carrying that momentum and confidence week in and week out helps a ton. And then, you know, I feel like if you do get off that track a little bit, you just kind of got to get home and regroup. You know, we had that happen a little bit earlier, you know, midway part of the year. We went and ventured out a little bit and did good and some nights, and then not so great the next. And then, you know, came home and just kind of got and what I felt like was my confidence back, because these are all new tracks and new places and new everything really for me. So all the way down to just, you know, the little things, knowing where the scales are at and knowing how tracks work and all that kind of stuff plays into it. This is my first time really being away from all my friends and family, I guess, in a sense, if you want to call it, out on the road, if you want. And so, like, it's just been definitely a different thing for me, and I had to kind of adapt to it. And luckily for me, I've kind of been welcomed here in Fremont with open arms by, you know, TJ, his family, Kevin, and all of his family and friends that are here. And I think that's a huge, you know, game changer on my end, is everybody being so friendly and open armed. I think that just kind of all plays into the mental side of things, because at the end of the day, I mean, I feel like that's a huge player in racing is mental.
Yeah, you brought up living here with TJ and all that, and we talked to TJ, you know, on the last episode, kind of about, you know, that move from, you know, Texas up to here, and, you know, TJ had family here and all that. For you, it's completely different. I mean, you're basically moving double the distance from California to here, You, as far as I know, don't have any, you know, family here or close family like that outside of, you know, the racing family. I mean, how has that changed for you? Is this like, is this your first time going on such an extended, you know, stay away from California and home?
Yeah, last year I went and was in South Dakota for like two and a half months racing with Shane Liebig. And things just didn't go according to plan. Him and I ended things great. I mean, he still helps me out, and him and I keep in touch, you know, fairly often. But yeah, I mean, before I moved here, I didn't, TJ and I have never met in person. We've known who each other are, I feel like, for, you know, a number of years, but had never actually met in person. And the first day we had met, I showed up with three bags and a tote full of stuff and was kind of like, well, I'm your roommate now. Like, thank you. And we've, you know, formed a great, great friendship. I look at him as one of my closest friends. You know, I mean, I spend pretty much every single day with him and with his girlfriend. And I mean, us to be able to get along as well as we do and then, you know, get to race against each other. And I feel like, you know, I lean on him when I need things and vice versa. And I mean, it just created a really great friendship. And then same thing with Kevin. We're together basically 7 days a week. And, you know, you kind of have to get along with somebody, especially when you're working with them, you're friends with them. You know, we go out to dinner together. And I mean, you have to have, you know, you have to be good friends in that aspect of things, considering how much time you're spending together. And, you know, before I moved here, obviously, I didn't know a single person. I had no friends here, no family here. So in that aspect of things, I've really relied on TJ and Kevin and all their friends and family, you know. And like I said, they've, you know, welcome me with open arms, which has been very big for me. You know, all my friends and family are back home, you know, over 2,000 miles away. So obviously, like, it's only a phone call or a plane flight away, but that's not something that can happen, you know, at the blink of an eye. So it's been awesome to be here and really looking forward to whatever the future holds.
How did you and TJ get linked up to make this whole deal happen? So I know you said you've never met him. You just show up one day with three bags. Like, how did all that get planned? Did you reach out to him? I assume the ride was kind of already maybe lined up. Like, how did all of that play out?
So obviously, like, last year I raced for Doc at Knoxville, which was just a super last minute thing. Their driver quit and they needed somebody to fill the seat. And I was there and had my stuff and we made that happen. And then through the winter or whatever, that transpired into what it is now. But I'd posted on Facebook that obviously that I was coming out here, that we were going to be keeping everything in Fremont. And I don't remember if Kevin had said something to TJ or said something to me. And we ended up texting back and forth that, like, hey, I'm going to be in Fremont. And if you don't mind, I don't honestly remember if he texted me first or if I had texted him. And I said, I don't really know what this looks like. This could last all year. This could last a month. You know, it's kind of one of those things you just don't know. Obviously, you want the best thing to be, which would be out here all year and continue that on even after this year. And he basically was like, hey, like, I have an open room. You're more than welcome to live here. Like, I don't want anything. You know, you can stay here for free. I have the room's open, so it's not a big deal. And I basically was like, well, I can't let you let me live there for free. So, like, we'll work something out. And it's honestly turned into a great thing. Like, it's been a ton of fun. We get along great, and I'm always a third wheel with him and his girlfriend. So I'm kind of like the person that's just always there. And we go and, you know, and enjoy our weeks and go on trips and do this and whatever. And so that's kind of how that connection happened. And one thing led to another. And here we are towards the end of the season, and things have obviously gone extremely well.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if you can share any light, you know, on what the future looks like currently. I know I heard you kind of mention, I think, Saturday night a little bit, that there wasn't really anything set in stone. I mean, do you have a direction that you think things are going, or that they're looking like they're heading, or is it still kind of pretty all unknown at the current moment?
It's, I mean, we have, you know, kind of an idea of what we're going to do. Obviously, a lot of things always come down to funding. So we should have a better idea here in the next, you know, 2 weeks on exactly what we're going to do. I've been really, really working hard to get some more sponsorship for next year, which is something that we've obviously had in the works a bit. But I've really pushed hard the last couple of weeks. And I think we have some good stuff lined up for next year. And like I said, and we should know here in the next couple of weeks. And I'm really hoping that everything plays out the way that Kevin and I would like for it to. And if so, then next year is going to be really good.
You guys looking to travel more? Or?
Like I said, we'll know here more in 2 weeks. Okay.
So that part's kind of really all still up there. Is the plan to return to the car?
I mean, I would really like to. That's kind of been our plan. We're going to have a sit down meeting here and go from there. And I really, really enjoy working with Kevin. I really like racing for Doc. It's like I said, it's been a ton of fun this year and I've really enjoyed it. And I mean, at the end of the day, for me, if I want to be successful and I want to go race and do good, but I also want to have fun while I'm doing it. Kevin and I have a ton of fun when we go racing together. He's extremely competitive. I'm extremely competitive. And I think we kind of feed off of each other on that and push each other to do that much better. The beginning of the year, like obviously I put a ton of trust in Kevin, cause I know his background. I knew people that he had worked with where he didn't know that side of me. Like, you know, he knew that I worked hard and knew that I wanted to be here. But now like he's my crew chief, but there's times where he leans on me. Hey, what do you think about this? Or, hey, what do you kind of think about that? Where at the beginning of the year, I just was like, this is all of you. And we went from there. And now I feel like it's kind of like a, well, we win as a team and we lose as a team kind of thing. And we've gotten extremely comfortable racing together. And I think it shows. I have a ton of trust in him. He has a ton of trust in me. Our car is obviously almost always really, really fast. And him and I can go back and forth. You know, he'll get on me and vice versa now, where before I felt like I always was like, man, I could have done this better. I could have done that better. Where now he, you know, he sees little things like, man, I wish I would have done that, or I wish I would have done this. So for me, that's huge. You know, he says like, hey, I messed up, or hey, you know, great job, you know, and that for me is huge. Those are little victories for me.
Yes. Did you ever think, you know, you talk about little victories. Did you ever think that you were going to be at this point going into the final week of the year, leading a track championship, knowing that if you go into the week, you know, barring anything crazy, that you can walk out of your first full year in a new car as a track champion at, you know, arguably one of the toughest tracks for, you know, weekly 410 racing in the Midwest?
I mean, it's always one of those things like you want to set yourself up mentally, like not for failure. You know, you want to have realistic goals and stuff like that. And we weren't fully committed to running the Fremont thing until about halfway through the year when we realized like, hey, man, like we might actually be able to win this thing if we just stick with it. And I feel like we've been one of the cars to beat along with Cap, Kale. And there's a few others in there that are our main competition week in and week out. And that wasn't on the top of our to-do list, to be completely honest with you. My goal was to win 6 races, which we actually hit last weekend. Kevin's was 10. And so given the right circumstances, we might be able to get, you know, a couple more here. And I mean, obviously I'd like to get to 10, but I think we only have 5 races left on our schedule and a handful of them are high limit and outlaw shows. So to be able to go run good with those guys or win would be awesome, obviously. So I think my goals for next year are going to be a little bit higher even. But before this year, I'd only ever had 1 410 win and it was in Australia. So I honestly had never won in the States in a 410. We had quite a few, you know, a fair amount of 360 wins, but the 410 stuff kind of died out there in California. So really, before this year, I barely had 50 starts in a 410.
I would have never guessed that. I don't think anybody would have probably really ever guessed that if they had to. Yeah, circle back here. And, you know, usually the guest gives a quote. I give a quote. I heard this one. I want to say it was like Sunday night, and I immediately said to myself, "That's going to be the next one for the podcast because I really like it." But it's live the dash. And from a racing standpoint, you're probably thinking, "Oh, it's the, you know, the dash. It's the trophy dash or the pole dash, or whatever." But it goes to your gravestone that there is a birth year and then there's a death year. And then all that divides, that's a dash. And within the dash, there is basically an entire life of memories, laugh, love, you know, in racing, wins, crashes, you know, all these things all happen, you know, in this dash. And life is so short that we sum it up by a dash. And I, you know, I heard that and I really started to think, and I'm like, you know, when the time comes, whether, you know, it's today, tomorrow, 10, 20, you know, maybe 50 years from now, you know, if my kids or my friends or family or whatever ever, you know, visited my gravestone, God forbid they don't hate me. But if they ever stopped and visited, you know, it's like, if they looked at it, you know, and they looked at, you know, the time that I was alive, what would they think? Would they be like, you know, he was happy, he was successful, he did everything he wanted to, he didn't let anything limit him and all of that. And that was like, for me, a very, you know, inspirational, you know, type of quote to hear and to kind of just think about when you put it in a perspective and, you know, take the blinders off of day-to-day life. Like, life is so short that, you know, it gets summed up in a dash. And in that dash, there's, you know, so many different ways that you could look at things. So, I mean, for you, like, you're what, 20?
24. I'll be 25 24, next
25.
Week.
So, you know, you're about to hit your quarter life crisis, as I call it. And, you know, you come from California, you come to Ohio, you're winning races, you know, you're competing for, you know, possibly a track championship and all of that. Like, that in, you know, all of its glory is basically, I think, living the dash. Because, you know, how there's so many kids, if you think about it, that are out there that are, you know, they would die to basically have an opportunity that you got. And, you know, or they wish that they could and all of that. And you actually get to go out and do it. And, you know, not only do it, but do it well and take advantage of, you know, the opportunity that you got in front of you. And I think that's, you know, that's true for, you know, guys like TJ too, who come from Texas to up here. And, you know, a lot of the California kids that come out here, you know, Buddy, Cole, Carson, you know, all of them. And even the guys, you know, that you look at that are, you know, probably on the lower side of the budget, but say, hey, like, all we want to do is race on a touring schedule for 1 year, and they go do it. And it, you know, not necessarily, it legitimately bankrupts them, but, you know, they know that financially it's going to hurt them, but they just want to do it. It's a dream of theirs, and they go out and accomplish that. So like, for me, I think that's just live the dash. And if you want to look at it in the form of a pole dash or, you know, a trophy dash or whatever, go ahead and say like, hey, if your goal is, you know, being the fastest ones and live life to the best, and if that means making the front row of a dash for the Outlaws, then, you know, so be it, type thing.
Yeah, I mean, one of my, you know, I guess kind of goals for this year was to enjoy it. there's been a couple of times where I look back and I'm like, man, like, this has been a lot of work, and man, I hope that I've made the right decision coming out here. And then, you know, getting closer to the end of the year, I'm very happy that I made the decision and kind of jumped in with both feet and decided to come out here, because where I'm at now is somewhere I've dreamt of being since I got into a sprint car, you know, being out here and racing and contending for wins. And, you know, in a sense, I feel like people kind of know who I am now. And that's obviously like a huge thanks to Kevin and Doc, because if it weren't for them, I wouldn't be here. That being said, obviously, like, I feel like I bust my ass. I'm in the shop every single day with Kevin. And I wouldn't change it for the world. I mean, I love what I get to do. There's not a day that I wake up and, you know, don't want to go to work. You know, I get to go and work on race cars. Who wouldn't enjoy doing that? And fast race cars at that. So that definitely makes it that much more fun. There's definitely been a couple of days where, you know, you're like, man, I'm really tired, or man, I don't want to spend all day there. But, you know, it's the drive to be successful and push yourself to be better and be, you know, I look back at, you know, where I was at 5-6 years ago, and it's like, well, I would have killed to be here, and now I am. So, you know what, you better get up and go and get to the shop. So I think I kind of look back on that. And, you know, I have my little brother at home who I talk to all the time, and trying to, you know, kind of lead by example of like, you know, if this is what you want to do, this is the time and effort and hours you have to put into it to be here. And he's doing a great job back home of that as well, in my opinion. So kind of try to lead by example for him.
Yeah, I do. I think I remember seeing something about you had a brother out there still that was, you know, racing. For, you know, being the older brother, obviously you're kind of the one that gets looked up to. How active of a role do you play in his development and his racing career? Especially being, you know, 30-hour or whatever it is to drive from here to there, you know, 6-hour flight. Like, how much can you give back to him from where you're at now and like take care of that and ensure that he's developing, you know, in a good way?
Yeah, I mean, I made it because I obviously knew previous years I wouldn't go to every race just because I knew like my off season was kind of my time to go and do some things that I like to go and do. This winter, especially knowing that I was going to be gone, I made it to almost every single race that I could in the wintertime when I wasn't working or I, you know, taking a couple weekends to kind of just go and do some things that I wanted to go. Also knowing that I was going to be gone and wanted to spend time with friends and family. But I mean, I watch every single race that I can. Usually we'll sit either at Frickers or actually last Saturday after the Jim Ford, I sat there and while everybody else was hanging out, I was watching his race. You know what I mean? And I instantly either text my dad or call him and just try and kind of communicate on things that I see or whatever. And if we get time throughout the night, I'll pull his races up and watch them when I'm not busy doing what we need to do at the track, which obviously can be a little bit difficult, but I try and talk to him every single week about, you know, stuff or my dad, even that I see that they, you know, he could communicate back to him. I got to obviously go home last month to go run some high limit shows and stuff like that. And it was awesome to go because I got to go to the showcase. He won two or three of the four features and I got to work with him, you know, both the days that I was there. And for being 12 years old, I mean, man, him in the race car, he has a ton of knowledge and he understands things and he sees things that I see, when other people race at 12, which for me is awesome because I mean, I feel like that's all he's known. That's what he's done. He played baseball and stuff like that, but deep down always, you know, he's wanted to race and he's done it extremely well. So it's been cool because I feel like he watches all my races and I know because my dad's even told me he takes things that I do and they talk about it and then he tries to apply it in the go-kart stuff or, you know, he takes stuff that other people do during the races and applies it to his racing as well. And like I said, being as young as he is and as smart as he is and like his racecraft is unbelievable. So I'm really looking forward to seeing kind of what he gets to do in the future, whether my parents, you know, move out here or stay there and run sprint car stuff. He's 2 years from being able to run a sprint car, actually a little over a year and a half. So like I said, I try and work with him as much as I can and I try and point things out. Like I had so much fun with him when I got to go home and race just because I hadn't been there all year, you know, watching on my phone or watching on the TV here is just so much different than being able to actually support him in person and communicate with him through the night versus over the phone or through text. So watching him grow as a racer has been a ton of fun.
Do you think he's better than you?
I mean, I feel like that's kind of a little bit of a loaded question. I think he's right there. Yeah. He is extremely well for his age. And I think he's going to give me a run for my money, to be honest with you, but I know he's got, you know, big shoes to fill in my opinion, without my head sounding too big, but, I don't know. I'm going to push him to be as good as he can. And if he is better than me, then that's awesome. I mean, that's all you can want. I mean, even though he is younger than me, I still do look up to him, you know, I mean, that's why I push him to be better. And I mean, what kind of older brother wouldn't want their little brother to be as good or better than them? You know what I mean? And if he is, then awesome. I'm happy for him. So, like I said, I push him and sometimes I think I'm a little bit too hard on him, but at the end of the day, like, that's what I'm there for. I want you to be better. So, you know, I know he's gotten mad at me a couple of times for getting on his ass about stuff. But I mean, like I said, if I see something, I'm going to say it and I want you to be better than me. And hopefully he is one day.
Yeah. So the point of podcast is loaded questions. It's the trick to trick you into saying things that you probably wouldn't normally, not in a bad way, but with your brother, obviously like, you guys share the same interests and all of that. So like that really has to help your guys's, you know, relationship together. Cause like me and my brother, we could not be complete opposites and, you know, it shows in my relationship with him, but for like you and your brother, obviously very shared interests and stuff like that. And, you know, there is a, you know, kind of a bigger age gap there than, typically you would see maybe between siblings that are kind of coming up the same path, which nothing wrong with that. I mean, for you guys, like, do you think that relationship is as strong as it is and even better because you guys have the same interests?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I feel like there was a long time that him and I weren't super close just because, I mean, I was growing up and I was hard-headed and, you know, wanted to go and do my own thing and this and that. But I think growing up and especially last year being, you know, leaving for 2 months and then this year now being gone for six, it makes me realize like, man, like I want to be as, you know, involved in it as I can. And I feel like it's made us that much closer, going home and spending time with my family. It's like, well, I had friends that wanted me to come and hang out or do this or do that. And the one night I did, and then, but I was like, I'd rather spend time with my parents and hang out with them, and my little brother, cause it comes kind of few and far between now. So, I feel like him and I are really close given how big of an age gap it is. And if I was to move back home, or if they were to move out here, I feel like it would just make that even stronger, just because I'd rather go and hang out at the racetrack and help him be better and whatnot than do really anything else.
Yeah. I mean, nothing stronger than brotherly love. Now, obviously your brother, you know, easy for him to kind of get into the sport with you already in it. How did your childhood all kind of play out? Like, what got you into it? Did your dad, parents, mom, or whatever, were they involved? Like, I mean, what was your introduction to racing? And obviously California's got a huge, you know, kart scene, especially, you know, outlaw style with the wings and all that. I mean, it's way bigger out there than probably anywhere else in the country. So like, I mean, how did you get your introduction to the sport?
My dad raced, actually. He was a really good California racer. He didn't really get a ton of opportunities to leave, which I feel like if he did, he would have excelled at. He didn't start racing until he was 22. And, you know, he had some help from some really close family friends, and he just kind of excelled from that. But, you know, it was a lot of trial and error on his part. He didn't have very much help, didn't really have that much knowledge on it. And honestly, he learned from trial and error. I feel like the turning point was when he got Larry Shelton on as his crew chief, and they went on to win a ton of races and championships and whatnot like that. And, you know, he's probably one of the most determined, hardworking people I've ever met. And I feel like that's kind of where I get my drive from, is, you know, watching him. He did it all on his own for the first however many years until he had gotten some rides and was able to race for some people. But truthfully, like, it boiled down to that he just wanted it more than the people around him, and he just worked more and worked harder. And, you know, he was one of the few guys I would think around there that would refresh his own motors up at Tony Barilo's, and would, you know, build all his own cars and take people's takeoffs, and, you know, then he'd go and beat them with it. And that was, you know, for me, that was always cool growing up, knowing that how hard he worked and how hard Larry worked for them to be better. You know, he's a 2-time Civil War champion, a 1-time Placerville track champion. He's won King of the West race at Placerville, and I actually was able to, you know, it's a cool goal, but kind of one of those things, like, I ended up beating him at the all times wins list at Placerville, and he was there, which that was the first race I think he had been to in like 2.5 months, because my little brother was racing and it was big trophy night. So like, for me, that one was really cool. So he's kind of always been my idol. I've looked up to him my whole life. So that's kind of how I got involved in it. And then he raced until he felt like he mentally couldn't do it anymore, just because of injuries and concussions and stuff like that. And then he kind of turned things over to me, and we went from there. That's actually how he met my mom. They met at Gold Cup of all places. My mom's pretty reserved. I feel like the last couple of years she's kind of, you know, really broken out of her shell, and I feel like became way more outgoing and stuff like that, but it's taken a while. She's always kind of reserved. But yeah, no, that they met at Gold Cup, and the rest is kind of history. I mean, she honestly wants to go racing more than my dad does. Sometimes it's kind of funny, cause he's like, man, I just want a weekend off, and they're headed wherever they can go, Oregon or Chowchilla or whatever that looks like. Like, she wanted us to pull another car down in Knoxville. Like, what? Like, come on, you know? And so that's how they met. And I feel like that's why we're so close as a family. I mean, my parents met at the races. She pushes us, he pushes us. So I think that's where that drive comes from, just because everybody wants to win. And I'll forever, you know, we run second sucks. You know what I mean? So, one of my dad's sayings has always been, you just got to want it more than the guy in front of you.
There's always someone to beat. is how I've always looked at it. Like, you can think you're the best, but there's probably always going to be somebody better. And
there's always going to be somebody better. And I mean, you know, there's going to be nights you have off nights, and there's going to be nights where you can't miss, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't think that we missed on Saturday and in any way, shape or form. And, I felt like we were really good, and whoever kind of got out front and didn't make any mistakes was going to win. And we ended up running second, unfortunately, but, hats off to those guys that won. I mean, can't knock them. So that's kind of how I think they felt on Friday. So,
but yeah, diving into Saturday there, you're starting obviously a different format than, you know, you're typically used to at Fremont, but you guys, you know, qualified well, go out there, do good in the heat. I mean, you won your heat, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you go second quick, you know, you win the heat. Obviously you're going to be the high point man by basically default. You start on the pole. You're starting on the pole for a $20,000 to win show. It's basically non-sanctioned, so you don't have, you know, any high limit or any outlaws there. So the chance of winning, you know, is pretty good, definitely, since you're, you know, doing so well at Fremont this year. Were you nervous rolling out there? I mean, what's going through your mind as you guys, you push out there, they do driver introductions, you get in the car, you're sitting there kind of in the dark until the lights come on, and then you push off. I mean, what's going through your head there?
I normally honestly don't really get that nervous. I get serious. I would say I'd get real quiet and don't like to talk or joke around the last, you know, 30 minutes before, just because I know what's on the line. I know how bad I want to win. So I kind of just get into this like almost tunnel vision until I get into the car of like, you know, I know I have a job to do and I need to perform and it's time to be serious. Like, yeah, you know, it's time to joke around or, you know, whatever through the night. But then I feel like that last, you know, 15, 20 minutes until we get going, I know it's time to kind of get in that mode of like, okay, it's time to go. I don't really get nervous. the driver intro thing's awesome. I love to incorporate the fans and incorporate people into it because obviously we're in the entertainment business, you know, we're there to involve them. And if it wasn't for the fans, then we wouldn't be able to do what we get to do every week. So like that aspect of things is cool, but it's the standing around and waiting. It's like, well, I'd rather just get in the car and go, because as soon as I get in and the car fires off, everything kind of goes away. My heart rate slows down and I know I'm good. Every other worry in the world goes away and I'm stress free. So
do you black out at all? Cause like for me, I'm one of those people that blacks out, like blacks out. Like I'll pass out and hit the floor. But if I get like nervous or like a moment gets intense, like I'll black out. And then if you ask me if I remember any of it, I'll be like, no, not at all. And I've talked to a couple different people that have been like, they've said like they'll black out. Like once they're on the track, they don't. But like if they're in stage or whatever and they're kind of waiting, they're like, yeah, I black out. I don't remember anything. And like I'm the same way. I get like nervous or something, or like I know the anxiety is kind of high. Like I will black out. And I don't remember any of it. Like, do you have that?
No, I pretty much could tell you almost every single lap throughout a race, like with, you know, within reason. But no, definitely can't say I black out.
It's one of those things, like either you do or you don't. The people that don't, I'm jealous of, because I wish I could remember certain things in my life that I'm like, I don't remember any of that. And they're like, it was literally 5 minutes ago. And I'm like, yeah, I don't remember it. Like,
yeah. One of my favorite things is whenever Kevin walks up right before he, you know, because 99% of the time he pushes me out on the track or whatever. My favorite thing is when he usually walks up to me and tells me whatever he says before we go. And that's one of the things I'll pretty much always remember throughout my racing is that, because it's usually something to, you know, kind of get me excited or make me laugh or whatever. Yeah,
it's like Ross Weiss video from years ago. He's like, don't suck to Darren Pittman. I think Darren won that night or whatever. And that's kind of been a running joke for years now, ever since that video came out. But
yeah, I think our kind of thing that we always go to is just go hammer it. You know, it's kind of his saying, or hey, I'll have, I'll see you on the front stretch, you know. And he quit saying that because we've ran like second three times now or something like that. So usually we don't say anything like that, but you know, something along the lines of hammer it, race smart, or you know, something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, everything is different. I know whenever I, you know, talk to Zane, like it's always like go do something cool.
Yeah.
You know, just things like that. Like it doesn't seem like a lot, but like if it's just something that you always do, like it kind of becomes habit, and then habit becomes ritual, and ritual becomes superstition, and it just boils into one thing and another. But Yeah. So you're out, you're not nervous for the race. You know, it goes green. You know, Cap gets out there kind of early. You end up reeling him back in. You kind of get, you know, next to him there in traffic. Obviously, if you watch, there's a contact with the lab car. I mean, it's just hard racing. You got to do what you got to do. And I get it. I would say, you know, collateral damage type thing. Like, you know, being from the military, like I've always kind of just said, you know, war is not great and innocent people get caught in the crossfire and stuff like that. But, that happens. The caution comes out. You guys reset. You know, we go through the race, and then kind of after that, you just, I don't think ever could get back up even with them to where you can make a charge. And I know we had talked right after that, you know, you thought you had a chance, but kind of just didn't get on that restart, you know, the way that you had wanted to, not that, it wasn't bad or anything, but you can't get there. You know, the race finishes. And like I was, you know, telling you, I wish I had a photo. I was in video mode when I saw it, and I have a video. But, you know, you pull up to the front stretch and I looked over and you had basically had your head buried in your hands. And I instantly knew, you know, this has got to be one of the crappiest moments for him all year because, he's so close. He had the car to win and all that. And eventually I'll get you that video so you can just kind of have it. But, you know, I saw it and it's one of those moments you don't see often. You know, at Fremont or Attica. And it's not to say that there isn't high stakes, but you know, the pits, you go in the pits are kind of secluded at both tracks. Like you don't get a good look from the stands, you know, at it. And then of course, you know, the whole right side of the car is kind of paneled up. So even if you're in the stands, you don't get to see it, but you know, I think that's like one of the first times I've ever seen somebody, you know, visibly defeated in that manner. You know, I just kind of watched it and I don't want to say cherish the moment because I don't know if that's the right word for it, but I kind of took it in and I was like, I get it. I understand, you know, I don't fully, we'll never know how he feels, but I get it. Like I get the emotion. I can feel it. You know, this sucks. How do you process through that? Cause you get out of the car, obviously. And you know, you took a seat on the wheel and, you know, kind of, again, took just a moment to yourself and then, you know, eventually you have to do the interview, you know, how do you process all of that? Like, how do you get your composure, you know, back enough to do the interview and kind of, I don't say move on with the night, but start taking steps forward. Cause obviously, you know, there's no do-overs and now you got to go do it again in 7 or 6 days.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I kind of got to look back like, okay, you know, 5-6 months ago, I'd have been ecstatic to finish second. Now it's like, man, we ran second. That sucks. So you kind of got to reflect back of like on that. But it definitely made it tough just for the fact that I felt like if we got out front, we were probably going to win and just got into the lap car the one time on accident and just misjudged, really was trying to clear Cap, trying not to run into the lap car. I was more worried about running into Cap, honestly. And I know that kind of sounds, you know, cruel, but we're racing for the lead. That's a lap car. I didn't mean to run into him, but you know, it is what it is. I just knew that if I could get in front of him and have a restart out front that we were going to be able to win. I felt like I threw everything I had at him. I mean, I threw the textbook at him. I tried everything, got to him twice in traffic and would catch a caution wrong or the red came out or just couldn't quite catch the brake that I needed. I felt like I didn't get a great start and knew I was like, okay, well, we'll hang out for a couple laps and see like what we have. And I was like, I know the car is going to get better, which it did. Trade gotten me. So I fell back to third and I was like, okay, like, hang out for another lap or two. And then we need to make an adjustment and push. And so prep the wing back a little bit more. And I was like, okay, like I need to see how hard I can push this thing because I can't let Cap get too far away from us and get to traffic because I need to be close to him when we get there. Just cause I know how good our stuff has been in traffic. And so I did and was able to get to him in traffic twice, like I said, and the yellow came out both times. And then just, it would take me a couple laps to kind of get going and get our momentum up. And one thing I've learned racing with Cap is if he gets out front, unless you can either get him to traffic or show him a nose and get him to change, he's going to be really hard to beat. And so he got out front again on one of the restarts, and I searched. I mean, I covered every lane on the racetrack trying to see if I could find something, and couldn't really find anything. And looking back now, there's a couple things that I would have done different. I'd have probably moved the wing forward a little bit just to help me get it off the left rear earlier. And then there was a spot in one and two that I found that I wish I'd have found about 5 or 6 laps sooner when I was close to him, because I couldn't really make it work by myself. But when we were around other cars, I made it work really good. So I guess kind of touching back on that, you know, you got to be able to pick yourself back up after running second, because, you know, at the end of the day, you still did run second. There's still, you know, 30 other cars that would have been happy to finish there. You got to put on, your game face for your sponsors and your car owners and whatnot or whatever. But I feel like, as you know, I've never been a car owner. My dad and I have owned our own stuff. But I've never owned somebody else's race car. Seeing somebody that you have hired to do a job be upset that they finished second should almost light a fire under your ass, because you know how bad they want it then. And how, you know, like, how often do you see people that run second in a race like that? A track they've never really, a track before this year they've never ran. People that they've never been around at a track that they're probably going to win the championship at be upset to run second. I just feel like it kind of lights a fire under your ass, because it's like, wow, they really do want this. That's just kind of what I look back at as, you know, 6 months ago, I'd have been happy to run second.
Is that the highest paying race that you've made the feature for? Or has there been higher before? I mean,
Trophy Cup. So I ran Trophy Cup, made that a couple times.
Did you make the feature at Gold Cup this year?
I didn't watch it too closely, but I thought you did. Yeah, I made the feature the last couple years at Gold Cup. I started on the pole 2 years in a row of our prelim night. But yeah, no, this would be one of the higher paying shows for sure. This would be, I would say, the highest paying show that we're going to be a car to be at. I feel like Trophy Cup, we've been really close. Like, I've led laps and we ended up fourth the 1 year, like with 3 to go, which was sucked because, you know, at least run top 3, you're on a podium. But
yeah, I think the mental approach to it changes too. Like you said, like Trophy Cup's, you know, one of the biggest races out on the West Coast. So like, you kind of go there and, you know, I don't want to say you never feel like you have a shot to win, but you know that the door is so open for anybody to win.
Yeah. I mean, 100 cars show up for it. And it's one of those races that kind of just got to let it all hang out. Cause if you don't, that determines your whole weekend. You know, with the 104 cars there, it's like your window is this big. And if you miss, somebody's going to fill it. So you got to have a perfect weekend to do it. And, you know, I mean, there's a handful of guys that go there and they're just exceptional there. That's probably the one track, you know, touching back on it, that I get nervous going to. I actually get nervous going there. I get butterflies. My belts are extra tight. I'm sweating like, but yeah, no, that's probably the only place that I would say that I go to that I actually get nervous at every time we go.
Interesting you say that, because I think a lot of people, you know, on the fan side, you know, always think the places you're the most nervous at are the scarier places. Eldora, Knoxville. Yeah, I would almost say, like, if you're a non-wing guy, I'd throw Terre Haute and Lawrenceburg in there. Like, those are two places. Like, the car count goes down at those places for a reason. And I think because, you know, guys are scared to, you know, run there. So it's like, it's interesting you hear you say that, because, you know, Trophy Cup, I mean, it's a fast track, but it's not like, it's not one that you would look at and be like, yeah, I don't know if I want to race there type deal. It's, you know,
I think it's just because usually we only go once a year. It's for Trophy Cup and everybody's there. You have to lay everything out on the line for 2 laps of qualifying, and that determines your entire weekend.
Yeah. The environment of the event.
Yeah. Like, we went back this year for the High Limit show and I was a little bit nervous, but I mean, that's just always kind of been there. That was the first place I ever flipped a sprint car at. And it's like, you know, that obviously kind of plays into it as like one of those core memories of like, this was the first place I wrecked at, you know what I mean? So, and I mean, I've wrecked there a couple more times since then, which it's to Larry, like it's going to happen. But it hasn't even been top 5 hardest wrecks I've ever had. So, that doesn't really play into it for me, to say the least.
So I'm kind of glad you brought that up. has there been a wreck that you've kind of like been like, oh shit, like this is, ooh, like it kind of taking you back, or they've all kind of just been like, oh, that sucked, but.
One of them wasn't actually even a wreck. I last minute deal, wasn't even supposed to be racing, got into an outlaw cart for one of my friends and had to start scratch because I didn't qualify and I didn't even run the heat race. They had me fill in as like, because they were whatever, long story short. And I went from the D to the B and was just out of a transfer spot in the B, and they wrecked in front of me. Well, when I was driving past, they were flipping and they clipped me. Well, when it did, it knocked me out, and I was unconscious for a long time. I think it was upwards of close to 3 minutes. Like it was a very, very scary deal. Don't remember about 2 weeks. Didn't even remember racing or driving to the track. Like, so like that one would definitely stick out to me because it took me probably 6-8 months to get back to where I was like, okay, like kind of normal now. So like that one would definitely be the one that would stick out to me the most on it set me back a long time. I felt like it took me a long time to get, you know, to where I was comfortable racing just because my reflex are slower. And it's one of those injuries you can't see. You know, head injuries are the worst injuries in my opinion, other than something physical that, you know, keeps you from doing life, you know, day-to-day life. The Knoxville one this year, that one, as much as I said, it didn't bug me or hurt, like it, that one took the wind out of me, for sure. And then, when I wrecked Jim Jensen's car at, that'd have been the Louis Vermeil in 2021, maybe, that one definitely hurt too. So I would say those would be the top three for sure that, you know, make you kind of step back, like that hurt, that hurt. And, you know, as a racer, you try and put that brave face on and kind of fake it because you don't want people to know, or, you know, and my kind of saying's always been racers race, you know what I mean? So, definitely put that brave face on a couple of times now and been like, you know, let's keep going. But then you get in your room by yourself or whatever you're doing, you kind of reflect like that one might slow me down for a little bit. So, and I think that's kind of what happened with the Knoxville one. That one definitely slowed me down for a couple of weeks. And it was kind of probably should have taken a week or two off, but knowing that I'm doing this for a living now and I have to pay, you know, my bills and this and that, I wasn't going to sit out.
Kind of like the rodeo world almost. And I'm going to tie this, the rodeo into this, because, you know, we talked to TJ, you know, I think a lot of people know that I spent some time in Texas. The rodeo world is, I don't want to say it's very like identical to the racing, because it's not, they're two different worlds. But the idea of like, this is how I pay my bills and I am going to tough through whatever this is pretty close to what I think I've kind of heard everyone say on the racing side. Like, you know, you look at bull riders, for example. I mean, it is the most dangerous sport in the world, without a doubt. I mean, it's 8 seconds. You're on an animal that basically all it wants to do is kick you off and then stomp the shit out of you. But, you know, those guys, you know, tear muscles, break bones, you know, knock their teeth out, get concussed. And it's like you watch it and you're like, oh, they're going to be out for, you know, that's at least 4 to 8. 48 weeks, 48 months. So yeah. Like, well, yeah, at least 4 to 8, you know? And then you see the news like the next day and they're like, oh, they passed concussion protocol. They're going to be back tonight. And if there's any rodeo listeners listening, the concussion protocol there, I think is all whack, but whatever. But like, you know, those guys are going out there broken legs and getting on bulls because they're like, and you ask them why, and they're like, well, it, you know, cowboy tough, but they got to pay the bills. And like that's how they do it. And, you know, you look at like the PBR on CBS and you're like, oh, cool. And like, I don't even think that's the hardest rodeo out there. I mean, those guys are getting on like the best of the best, for example, but like they're doing it 3 days a week and it's on the weekends. Yeah. What you don't see as often is like, you know, the pro rodeo guys that are rodeoing every day or every other day all summer long. And it's not like, oh, we're going from this town to this town. They're 10 minutes away. They're rodeoing here. They're flying to this city and two states away. And then they're coming back to where they were at because it's the finals or whatever. And they qualified and, you know, they're traveling, they're getting beat up, hurt, all this stuff. And then it's just like, you know, they kind of come to the point and it's like, oh, I'm beat up, but I got to do it. Yeah. And you know, it gets to the point for them where, you know, they go through so much of that and they tear their bodies up to a point where it's kind of like, you know, I need to stop. I have to stop. Like, I have to surgically get my body repaired at this point. And then, you know, they look at it and they say, well, I'm going to be out, you know, basically 8 months until this heals. And they're out 8 months. And then it's like, as soon as that 8 months in, they're back into it. Yeah. And then typically they're kind of already back into it before they're ever healed. So they re-injure it. And then, you know, they're out, like, well, now I'm out a year and a half because I have to get it repaired again. Like, you know, JB Mooney, a great example, like, the guy has broken his neck, I think, like, 8 times. Like, the dude's the best bull rider of all time for a reason, you know, but, like, that guy has beat his body to absolute oblivion. And, like, now you watch him, like, if you ever meet him in person, if you ever go to a rodeo and get to meet the guy, wonderful. But he walks like he's a, like, every bone in his body is a like a peg leg off of a pirate, and he can't move any of his joints because he's abused it so bad. And, you know, instead of taking time to heal, he was like, oh, this is how I make a living. I got to do it. And it's, you know, you brought up the concussions, and we're really in a period now in like life and society that that stuff's really, I think, finally getting the attention that it probably deserves. Yeah. And, you know, all due credit to the NFL for that, because I think they're the ones really highlighting the most of it. But like the CTE stuff is, you know, that's real. And you look at like Tua Tagovailoa and everything he's going through. And that same stuff is, you know, it's happening in racing, and you just don't ever really, I think, hear much about it because guys are kind of like, I got
kind of band-aid it,
but yeah, like, I'm still going to race because that's what I got to do. You know, on Zane's episode, that first episode, he kind of talked about what he had gone through with, you know, his deal and all of that. And I had a lot of people kind of come up to me, you know, and they're like, hey, we really appreciated listening to that. And because that's like something that, you know, we would have never heard of. Like, we didn't know that, you know, this is happening as often as it is. And I had an idea, obviously, you know, being involved, but like, you know, you had mentioned it there, like, you get knocked out. Typically when you get knocked out, you have a concussion with it. I mean, they go hand in hand, and yeah, you know, you get guys get knocked out, and they get out of the car and they're back the next night, and you're like, oh, you know, it's good to see they're healthy, but realistically they're probably not. And it's one of those things, it's like, you know, you said it took 8 months to feel fully back from that, and it's, you know, that's a real thing. Like the concussion head stuff is real, and you know, it does affect you down the road, you know, days, months, even for some guys years afterwards. Like, I think we're finally, you know, I would love to talk to Rico about, you know, his whole deal, because, you know, after the midget flip at Eldora, like, it just never seemed like he was kind of the same Rico there for a long time. And, you know, now he's back to where he was, and it's great to see. But, you know, that stuff really kind of plays a role into it.
You know, I kind of touched on it. It's one of those things that you can't see. So it's like, well, out of sight, out of mind kind of thing, until it turns into something that you can see. You know, you get, I feel like, mood swings and, you know, it's different for every person, but I mean, I definitely noticed that on mine. Was my mood swings were through the roof. One minute I'd be as happy as you could be, then I'd be super, super mad, and then I'd be sad, and then I'd be happy again in one day. And it was just like up and down. And like, that's kind of when I realized, like, I had to sit down with my dad and my mom, and I was like, we either need to like take a little bit of a break from racing, or like, I need to do something to like help this, because what we're doing right now is not working. And luckily it was kind of getting towards the end of the race season, so I had time to kind of like rest and not do much. I just focused on working and whatnot or whatever. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing with the head injuries, you just can't see them. So you think, oh, okay, well, I'm fine. Well, you know, everything's kind of off, everything's slower, or, you know, it just makes it difficult, because, you know, you just want to put it at the back of your head and keep going, you know. Or like another thing that I had, my memory was horrible for probably a year and a half, like horrible. You and I could have a conversation, and if it was under, you know, a minute, or if it wasn't like anything major, I'd forget. Couldn't tell you. Wouldn't remember.
Yeah. I had a friend in high school that did motocross, supercross, whatever it is. But I remember one day he came into school, and they, like, the doctor was like, you can't do any math. And I was like, that's a thing? And he was like, yeah, I'm not allowed to do math. And I was like, whoa, like that's crazy. And I didn't have a good understanding of anything then. And like, now it's like, I look back and I'm like, damn, like that concussion you must have was bad. Cause like, if you're getting told that you can't do math because it's going to force your brain to activate in ways that aren't going to be good for your brain, like, you're talking, you know, serious things. And you know, you get to a point too, and I think Zane had mentioned in the first show, you know, having a concussion is already bad enough. If you don't let it fully heal and then you have something happen and you add another one on top of it, that second one is, it's not twice as worse, not three, it is like 10 times worse. Yeah. And, well, and like those lasting effects.
I kind of rang my bell earlier this year in Australia. I flipped. It wasn't even really it's kind of, you know, crazy how that works. It wasn't even a bad flip. We put a front end in the car and a top wing, and that was, didn't bend radius rods or anything. It literally just bent the front end. And, but the way it landed on the left side, like nose down, really hard and weird. And it, I think it hit my head off the left side of the headrest and it knocked me out. I mean, not for long, probably 15 seconds, but enough to be like stunned. I don't even know if so much that I was even out. It was more or less like ears were ringing, vision was kind of blurry. They're yelling at me, and I'm in Australia, so some of them guys' accents are pretty thick. And I had a concussion, you know, and I fought it. I was like, I wasn't knocked out. Like, I'm fine, you know, this and that. And like I said, I don't know 100% that I was so much knocked out. It just more or less rung my bell. And for those of you that haven't had a concussion, like, you know, my ears were ringing, like, so loud that it sounded like I just had a bell blown in my ear.
Yeah, I would. Have you had your wisdom teeth removed?
I have. Yeah.
Did you go under for that?
Yeah.
Did you get the weird anesthesia where like you're awake but you're not awake?
No, I was. I was out.
Okay. So like for me, when I had my wisdoms removed, they gave me this weird anesthesia, and like I was asleep. Like I don't remember visually anything. But like I remember them talking to me and like telling me to do certain things with like my jaw and all that. Like I was awake enough to know that.
Yeah, no, I was.
But
out.
Like I was asleep, and I was like, "Is that what anesthesia is like?" And they're like, "No, like true anesthesia, you're out." But apparently, there's like this new anesthesia out there where it's, you know, it puts you to sleep so you don't feel the pain, but like you're still aware enough to like react, and it's kind of like this weird dream state almost.
Yeah, I don't know that I like that.
It was weird to me, but like I'd almost think like, you know. You talked about like, you know, didn't feel like you were knocked out, but you weren't there. And it's like, I was curious if you had ever had that, if you could compare it to it, because like I would, you know, based on what you're saying, I think that's what I would think it would be like, is like that weird, like, you know, your lights are on
and you're like
halfway out the door.
Yeah.
Like one hand is still in the door trying to find the light switch and the other one's checked out playing in the street.
That's kind of how I felt after I got out of the ambulance at Knoxville and they did my interview. I had a bunch of people text me and call me about it. And they're like, you look like a deer in headlights. Like you were pale and like you are not the lights were on, but nobody was home.
Yeah. When you truly have those moments too, you don't know that nobody, like, you don't know the lights are on and nobody's home either. Cause like you feel fine. You're like,
I felt okay. Yeah. Like, you know, and then, a couple days later, I was like, nah, I'm not okay, but I'm going to put on a brave face and going to do my job. So if Kevin and Doc wanted to pull down another car, we would have pulled down another car and I would have raced, you know, but Doc definitely wanted us to. And Kevin was like, we're not doing that. Like, we're not doing that.
What that happened in the prelim night, right? I didn't really watch too much.
It happened on Friday. So we ran our prelim night No, it did happen on our prelim night. Yeah, in the heat race. Because we actually qualified okay. And then I just didn't get a good start. And I was just trying to make up for it too much and just made a mistake, got up over the curb and got into the wall. So that one was 100% on me. Yeah,
and that's kind of one of those situations too, I guess you could look at and be like, you know, what position are we in moving forward? Like, you know, are we in a position to where we, you know, have a legitimate chance at maybe, you know, doing well. And, you know, if we do, I think, you know, you throw a little bit, maybe more caution to the wind in that situation to where, you know, if you're, you know, you qualify well is great. You know, you get good points out of that. But if you, you know, you wreck in the heat race, you got to start low in the, you know, the consolations. And
we were done for that night, no matter what. But like we could have ran a car on the hard knocks night or whatever it is for Friday.
Yeah. But then
just wasn't worth it because if something else happened and we killed another car or wrecked or whatever, like it was just going to make the rest of our season that much harder and, you know, make money financially that much tighter just because we would have been short on kind of equipment. We needed to put the bigger picture at, you know, the front, which was obviously Fremont and Attica and then whatever else we had left in Ohio. I had hardly any laps at Knoxville other than like the previous year. I ran one race and then nationals. So I had 50, 60 laps maybe there total. So Kevin kind of knew that and was like, it just doesn't make sense for us to do this. You know what I mean? So kind of regroup, and obviously we got back to Ohio. And
you guys stayed out there for the rest of the week though?
Yeah, Kevin was ready to come home. And like, honestly, like if we would have left, I'd have been totally okay with it. But instead we ended up staying and hanging out or whatever. So it was good though, because I know Kevin had his daughter with him, so it was good for him to spend a bunch of time with her, and they had a bunch of fun and got to do that kind of stuff.
Does it drive you to want to go back and do better when you're sitting there on Friday and Saturday night? You're kind of just watching it and you're all like, we that could be us type moment.
100%, especially because I have so much confidence and trust in Kevin, that obviously pushes that side of things.
You brought up Kevin a couple times here, and maybe one day we'll get him on here so we can, you know, hear his side of the story. But like, tell everyone a little bit more about like his experience. Cause you know, a lot of people might not know that background. Like he's been with, you know, some pretty good teams in the past, you know, drivers are kind of working their way up through the national ranks. Like, you know, how does, you know, what's the story there? And then like, how does you use that to your advantage, you know, with him?
Yeah. So like Kevin grew up in Pennsylvania, 5 minutes from Williams Grove. His dad is a fan. He started kind of going as a fan, and then he started working on, I think they're like the 358s or something like that. I don't really know much about them. One thing led kind of to another. He started working for, I don't remember like the exact like order that everything kind of played out, to be honest. I don't remember off the top of my head. But I mean, he's been on national teams. He's worked with, you know, the Blaneys. He's worked with Parker Price Miller. He's worked with Anthony Macri. He's worked with, Brent Marks. Like, so I mean, he's very, you know, knowledgeable and been around it a long time. And, you know, I mean, just you, if you're around those kind of quality and, you know, level of people, you're going to learn. And then one thing kind of led to another, and he got the crew chief role. And, you know, he worked on the 11 with Sam McGee's car when Spencer was in it, and Parker Price Miller, and with Hunter Schoenberg, and like all those guys. I mean, and obviously you name off that, just off that list, I mean, look at the level of, you know, I mean, the level of drivers and stuff that there is there. So, I mean, he's very knowledgeable. He's been around for a long time, and in my opinion, one of the best crew chiefs in Ohio.
Yeah, you do get, you know, I knew about McGee, so like I was kind of familiar with that. I didn't know about Marks or anything like that. So, I mean, you get a lot of differing backgrounds there too, especially, you know, for him to come out of PA. I think everybody, you know, in the country knows that, you know, that racing out there is a different world. Compared to anywhere else, like Williams Grove, Port Royal are their own unique joints. And you got to learn things, I think, to set stuff up and to drive at those tracks completely different than anywhere else. So, you know, if you have that, you know, I would say tool in your toolbox, you know, per se, that like, you know, bring out here, Fremont's not anything like either of those places. But like, if you have something out there that you've learned that you might be able to apply here, you know, I think that would almost, you know, I would venture to say kind of maybe give you an advantage. Because he might know something that, you know, nobody here would happen to know, just because they're not, you know, maybe familiar with setting something up that would fit conditions that you'd get out there. Because I went to a race at Williams Grove about 5 years ago, and literally the first words I think I said was, it's weird to see sprint cars break going in a straight line. So like it's a different world out there. You have to do things completely different. So like I can only imagine that the skill set that he's got is vastly different and more broad than maybe what you would see, you know, out of guys that are, you know, pretty focused on maybe just Fremont, Attica, Wayne County.
It's definitely taken me, like it took me a handful of races to kind of get used to driving the car the way he sets it up. I definitely had to change my driving style a little bit, and he's kind of changed, you know, what he does a little bit just to kind of help me get more comfortable. And then I feel like we've gotten definitely back onto where he likes the car to be, and I've adapted my driving that much more to it. But I mean, just the knowledge that he has and stuff like that, especially on dry slick racetracks, I mean, is unbelievable. And some of the stuff that he does, I kind of sit there and scratch my head like, how in the hell is that gonna work? But I mean, it does. And then, you know, we get a hooked up racetrack and like, he's like, oh, you just got to drive it the first handful of laps, but I promise the car will come to you. And that's kind of been our thing. It's like, you know, if you end up our second, third or fourth, you know, hang out, but don't let them get too far. And then he's like, the car will come to you. Like, kind of felt like that's what happened Friday. You know, Schaaf was better early, in my opinion, the first probably 10 or 15 laps. And then our stuff just kept getting better and better. And I knew the harder that I drove it, the better we were. One of my favorite things to an extent that I've had to change or adjust my driving style is I feel like our right front's almost always off the ground. Like if you look at any picture or any video, the right front's going to be off the ground of our car, but it just makes so much drive and so much straightaway speed that it kind of offsets it almost. And it's been a ton of fun to drive. There's been nights, one of the nights this car that we're actually running right now, I had wrecked at Sharon and we had to pull our third car out and get it ready because we had a race the following weekend. And after hot laps, Kevin got back and just couldn't stop laughing just because of how much drive the car had. And I was like, what? Like, I don't know why that's funny to you, but I'm like, that's, you know, that's just the, you know, car we've never ran, a car I've never sat in, and we're 4/10 faster than anybody in hot laps. It's like, okay, well, whatever we're doing is obviously working from car to car. So we just need to kind of keep doing that. And we've tried a couple little things and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And then we've tried something a couple weeks ago and it hit and it was like, whoa, okay. You know, and I feel like the latter half of the season, we've kind of come into it because him and I have gelled that much more. And that has made a huge difference.
I'm going to change topics here. I thought about it while you were talking there. And somewhat similar, I guess. You guys pit at Fremont in the back part right off of 4, it seems like every week. I don't think I've seen you guys park really anywhere else.
Turn two.
I can't count. Maybe I got a concussion, can't do math. Turn two, you guys park in the back there. Is that superstition?
No. Honestly, the only superstition that I would say that I have is I put my right glove on first every single time. And if for some reason I got to pull my right glove off to do something, I'll pull my left glove off with it too. Not really a superstition. I will say though that we have not ran any worse than second parking in that spot all year though. So we've changed it a couple times and we ran like third or fourth, or one night we ran like seventh. So I'm like, I told Kevin last week and I was like, if anybody's parked in that spot, I'm going to hook to it and pull it out of the way. Cause I was like, that's our spot. So no, not really a superstition, because I mean, we could park in a different spot this weekend and win, you know what I mean? But I'm very much a repetitive person, because if you do the same thing time and time again, you're not going to mess up and nothing's going to get forgotten. So if you do things in the same order, then it just becomes second nature and you don't forget things, you don't mess things up, and it just like kind of goes smooth.
Yeah. I ask because like everyone's typically got like their spot that they park in, but there's always some flex in it, whatever you want to use there. And like, maybe they'll be here one day, but like the next week, and they're like three spots over. Every time I've walked back there, it is like I could paint a line and you guys would be parked exactly on it. And I don't think I've seen precision like that out of anybody other than maybe like DJ and Zeth, because they park in the same spots every week as well.
And it's kind of become like, well, that's their spot. You know what I mean? And you honestly, with like kind of parking there, it's just 99% of the time it's Kevin and I. Our truck and trailer is really long, so it's hard to get in and out. There's people that park around us that'll help us like back the car out and stuff like that. So like it just makes it easy. And usually like if we run Friday at Attica, we'll just go over there first thing Saturday morning and we unload and we just stay there to service and do everything that we need to do. So a little bit convenience, a little bit like, well, we're running every weekend that we've ran here, we've ran no worse than third or second, I think. So it's like, well, we'll just kind of keep doing it.
Yeah. You talk about servicing between Fremont and Attica and Fremont Friday, Saturday. How much work do you do throughout the week at the shop? Like where is the shop local to Fremont, or cause I don't even know where you guys keep the car.
It's right here in Fremont. I mean, it's a mile, a little over a mile from here and less than 2 miles from the track. So, but like I said, typically it's just Kevin and I. Doc comes when he can. And I mean, like, obviously it'd be great to have Doc there every week, but you know, he's got his own life and you know, he's a doctor. So he was on call and stuff like that. So he doesn't typically come that often, which they watch every single race. I mean, he sits there and I'm sure I've never watched him watch me race, obviously, but I'm sure he sits there and paces and yells at the TV and whatnot. Maybe not quite that extent, but during the week, it's just Kevin and I at the shop. I mean, we kind of take our time there for a while. When it was real hot, we'd go and wash Saturday night after the races or whatever. Just because we're up, we're dirty, just go get it done. But it's kind of turned into now, but we just go park the truck trailer back at the shop. And then we'll typically go grab dinner with, you know, DJ and Foose and his wife and Kevin and his fiance and kind of whoever else comes. TJ comes and Chris Andrews and like that. We kind of have our little group.
Yeah, the one night I went, you weren't there.
I know. Yeah, I'd say most of the time we go do that. But Mondays, usually we'll wash and get the car in the shop and kind of Kevin will do motor maintenance and we'll kind of start on our stuff there. But I mean, we're in the shop every day. We kind of typically just find stuff to do because, I mean, that's what both of us do full time. So, I mean, like if you walk in our trailer or walk in our shop, it's as organized and as clean as we can make it. I mean, everything has a home. Everything, you know, everything's always fully stocked. Like, I think it's because we take pride in what we do. So we want it to be right. We typically, like I said, try and keep ourselves busy. I mean, like there's been a couple times where we come in late or leave a little early here and there. Like when it was really hot, we'd go in a little bit earlier and then just leave a little bit earlier just because it would get so hot in the shop. But and then like Friday, we'll wash and then just go park the truck trailer at the track. And then we'll just go unload at, you know, 9 a.m. or whatever time that is. And service until we get going. You know what I mean? Usually Kevin will just stay at the track or we'll finish servicing and load up quick and then run home because it's a mile. So it's not like it's like very far. But typically, like, we wouldn't need it to be 40 hours of work, but we kind of always find stuff to do and make our stuff right.
Yeah, I know I'm going to tie back to the superstition part here too, because we had talked about this, you know, last week when we recorded TJ's episode. But, you know, you talk about you always put the right hand glove on first and all that. For everyone, like for anyone or for everyone listening, what is your like daily schedule or like your daily routine look like for a race day? I know that you kind of laid out what you do, you know, when we talked last week for when we did TJ's episode. But like for everyone else, like what do you do on your race days? Like how do you prepare?
For like Attica on Friday, I'll probably sleep until 9 or 10 and then I'll lounge around and go grab a coffee or something like that and come back. I try and eat something light. And then I like eating sandwiches on race days because they don't mess my, like, I don't have to worry about it hurting my stomach. It's bread and meat. So, I mean, like, there's not really anything in it that's going to like mess it up. So that's like typically, I would say 99.9% of the time, that's what I'm going to eat. I'm going to eat a sandwich from, if I'm back home, there's a couple different places that I go to, but like here, Jimmy John's. Like Kevin calls me Jimmy, like just cause that's my go-to on what I eat on race day. And then I'll meet Kevin at the shop and we'll go to Attica or whatever. And then Saturday, some days I can sleep in, some days I can't. I like to be the first one there. So, usually Kevin and I will say, oh, we'll be there at 9 and I'll show up at 8:45. You know what I mean? Like I just, one of those things. I try and be early, but like Saturday this weekend, we're just going to leave the trailer at the track. So we'll just meet there in the morning. Like last weekend, I couldn't sleep. I finally fell asleep like 3 and then I woke up at 6:30 and I was up. So I just kind of hung out for a little bit cause I didn't want to get to the track at 7 a.m. So like I rolled over there at like 8:15, 8:30 and Brian Sabuto was already there unloaded working on his stuff. But
did he do karaoke the night before?
Did I?
No, did Brian?
I'm not sure.
That's probably why he was there so early.
Maybe. I don't know. They camped. I know that they camped, but I left early. I hung out for a little bit and then I did my Irish goodbye and left. So, but yeah, I definitely changes day to day. But I try and kind of stick somewhat in my same routine. Like once we finish servicing, I'll typically run home and take a quick shower just to wash off. And Kevin gives me crap for it because he's like, you're just going to get dirty again and sweat. But I don't know. I like to be clean before I put my suit and stuff on. I don't know. That's just one of those things, I guess. Or if I have to, I'll take a quick shower in the toter. So, but it definitely changes from day to day depending. So given that we don't tear anything up, it's pretty easy. So, which makes things nice. But Kevin and I have our little bit of routine down with car maintenance and motor maintenance and stuff like that. So like, if he's doing something that I know, hey, I can't pull the rear bars out or do this or that, I'll just start working on tires or clean the trailer or something like that. One big thing that I like, actually, we clean, like Kevin is OCD and very clean. We hands and knees clean the floor every week. So doesn't matter. It hands and knees, it's cleaned. So, but it's how you keep your nice stuff nice, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're centered around in the world of dirt in general, like I think you naturally want to not be in it. So you would like to have a clean environment. So I get that 100%. You brought up Jimmy John's, obviously from California. So I'm going to ask, In-N-Out, yes or no?
Oh, yeah. 100%
yeah, In-N-Out. If you had Whataburger.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Oh, this is the end, is the end of the podcast because we can't continue this.
I would rather go, it's right there equal with Burger King. I'd rather go to McDonald's than Whataburger. And for everybody listening, you guys can give me all the hate you want. That's fine. I'm California In-N-Out, born and raised.
Don't worry, I'll just edit this to make it sound like you said you love Whataburger and hate In-N-Out. I don't hate In-N-Out.
I think it depends on location sometimes, just like anything else. And maybe my one Whataburger experience I've had was just,
where'd you get it?
Oklahoma. So not that far. I mean,
that's not Texas though.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Real question is, how long did you wait in the drive thru?
I don't remember. I think we went inside.
Ah, that's a bold decision, but probably the right one, to be honest. I had In-N-Out, I think, four times in my life. I had it three times in California, and then I had it once in Austin, Texas. That was probably my mistake.
Probably.
The Austin one was, I did not enjoy it. The couple times in California, the first time I didn't get it animal style or whatever it is. Is it animal style?
Yeah.
I didn't get it that, and I was like, this is pretty lackluster. Like, it doesn't blow me away. The second time I got it animal style. And I was like, this is significantly better than that. But even then, I wasn't like blown away by it. And then I had Whataburger for the first time. And I was like, this wait is atrocious. But like, this is probably the best thing I've ever eaten in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was not a huge fan of it.
Oh, dude. I lived off of that when I was in Texas.
When I went home last month, I pretty much lived off of sushi, Chick-fil-A, and In-N-Out. Those were my three.
Sushi's too expensive for me to... I love sushi.
There's a couple places that we go to, like you can, you know, two rolls and like I typically get like the spicy edamame and a soda for like $30, $35. So I mean it's reasonable, but I was like, I'm only gonna be here for 2.5-3 weeks. So I was like,
yeah, I might as well shell out.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, yeah, when I lived in I think I had Whataburger twice a week. I had Cane's once a week. And then I probably had like a large drink from Sonic every other day just because they were $1 if you ordered them through the mobile app, and it was on my way to work. So I'd be like, gotta stop.
My Sonic. Biggest thing is coffee. I really like coffee.
I hate it.
I
will drink iced coffee or coffee. I don't frappuccinos, like, you know, call me basic and y'all can send all the hate mail right to my email. That's fine. But like, I hate hot coffee. And if it's cold coffee, like iced or whatever, I'll go to Starbucks and I'll be like, I want a caramel, like drizzled iced coffee, but I want like 80 pumps of caramel. Like, I don't want to taste any of the coffee. Just give me the caramel syrup bottle. I'll drink that. Like, that's how I like my coffee.
I don't like hot coffee really either. It could be 20 degrees outside and I'll drink
iced coffee. I pound soda. It's so bad. It's so bad for me. Like, I'm amazed that I don't have kidney stones at this point in my life. Like, I drink at least 3 bottles of Mountain Dew a day. And I've tried to like cut it back. Like, I've cut it back a lot. But when I was 24, living on my own for the first time, I think I went through like a 12 pack a day. And I was like, this is not healthy. Like, I was addicted. Like, I was an alcoholic with Mountain Dew. And I've weaned myself off. So that's good. I think I've learned that it makes me super shaky. So when I go back and look at my camera footage and that stuff looks like terrible, I'm like, yeah, I gotta cut back on that. Same way with energy drinks. I used to drink.
Yeah, I was really bad on Red Bulls for a while.
I can't drink Red Bulls. Red Bulls, I had one when I was like 17, I think. And it like gave me vertigo. Like, I was in the shower and all of a sudden the world started spinning.
Yeah, I felt like I was on mushrooms. I drink a Red Bull Saturday right before the main event, just a small one.
I can't. I can't. At least, I mean, I guess the Red Bull supports racing, so I can.
Yeah.
I can that somewhat and get behind else. That. Yeah. I mean, if I ever had some banana idea that I was like, no one's ever going to do this, I'm just going to call it Red Bull because they'll probably figure it out.
Yeah.
Like they had that recent video, the guy on the train BMXing from car to car, and I'm just like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever witnessed, but it's cool.
Yeah. Or they had like a then F1 car towing a guy barefoot through like some Everglades. You know what I mean? Like, where do they come up with that stuff?
Yeah. Well, I hate they don't do it anymore. They used to do like the New Year No Limit deal.
Yeah.
And like some of those things that they did there were absolutely insane. Like the Robbie Madison, when he jumps up onto the arc and then drops back down, you're just like,
yeah,
oh my God.
Yeah.
These dudes are fearless. Like, I look at race car drivers and I'm like, they're pretty brave. And I look at guys that like race supercross, motocross, freestyle, and I'm like, you're even crazier. Like, insane. And like, we like TJ talked about cardiovascular health and like racing's pretty active, like with the wheel, but you're sitting. And I look like the supercross guys and I'm like,
I will stand up. I will say supercross is probably one of the most physically demanding sports there is. That touching on that though, I would definitely say driving a 900 horsepower race car that weighs 1400 pounds with the driver in it is, I wouldn't say right there with them, but it's not easy.
I would say of all the car racing forms, I would put it like the top for being the most physically challenging.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, I feel like F1 probably just because those drivers, like how fast they're going and the G's and stuff like that. I've never obviously been in one, so I wouldn't know. And I don't know anybody personally that's driven one, but definitely, I would say it's right there with the one of the hardest things to drive.
Yeah. I mean, it's like my people are always like, what's so cool about it? I always just do, well, it's got 900 horsepower and only weighs 1500 pounds. I mean,
yeah,
there's nothing else in the world that's like that. Like, no. An F1 car is close, but it's still not the same.
No.
Like, I mean, there's, it's one of one.
Yeah.
I'm like, if you want to see things that you're like, how's that even possible? Just go to a sprint car race.
And I feel like our racing last couple of years have been, you know, pretty good. They've made some changes to like our rules and stuff like that, which I think has kind of made some of the racing lackluster. You know, you'll get like the last lap pass or this or that or whatever. But I mean, like, I feel like honestly, our racing this year has been pretty good. I mean, like, stuff that I've paid attention to around here. I feel like some of the like national events haven't been as much as I felt like they could have been or should have been. But I know our racing around here has been really good.
Yeah. I mean, I think TJ and I touched on it. Like, it's, this year is probably one of the best years I think I can recall in a pretty long time.
Yeah.
Just with the quality of one tracks, but the quality of racing in itself and all of that. So I mean, yeah, it's just, it's crazy to think about. And then we're getting towards the end of the episode here. But I do want to ask, you know, a couple questions, kind of just dive into things a little bit more on the personal side. What's your favorite color?
Man, that's a tough one. I'm very like a, I wouldn't say plain person, but I like bland stuff. So like shirts wise, I don't really wear them much, but I go with whites or blue would be like, I guess that's kind of like a pretty like common.
I say color. Blues are common. I feel like that's a,
not t-shirt wise, sorry, but like t-shirts wise, I'm like, I'll wear a lot of tan stuff just because they're kind of bland and they're neutral, you know what I mean? But like every nice vehicle I've ever owned is white. Our race cars have always been black. So I would say probably like blue or red. I know those are very opposite colors, but I definitely like those, especially like accent stuff. So
yeah, and I'm stealing this idea from Chris. And at the end of his episode, he quizzes me and all that. And that'll, you know, everyone will get to listen to that. So I'm stealing the idea from him, but he made his racing base. And I was like, well, that's not the point of the podcast.
Yeah, it's hard for me to pick just one color, to be completely honest with you.
What's your favorite food? If you say some California,
no, wireless. Growing up, my mom, she cooks and I pretty much would eat anything that she would make. But like coming from kind of an Italian background. I can never go wrong with really anything Italian. I really like fettuccine Alfredo, chicken fettuccine Alfredo, something along those lines. But once again, it's like, I like to switch it up. I don't like to eat the same thing. But if I was going to be like, okay, I got to pick one meal, it'd probably be like a lasagna or chicken fettuccine Alfredo.
I can respect lasagna. I could probably eat lasagna every day of my life until I died, to be honest. Okay. Some listeners are going to understand this one. They're going to laugh. And some are going to be like, why the hell is he asking that question? What's your favorite dinosaur?
That's a tough one. Because off the top of my head, I can't think of that many. Like, obviously, you have, like, the T-Rex and, like, a Velociraptor and some stuff like that. But, man, I don't know.
You're going to meet your future wife one day by asking her this question. I'm calling it now.
Maybe this is your revenge for me asking last week and during the Queens contest what animal they would be.
I had no idea that happened.
Yeah, last week I asked them what animal they would be and why. So I guess this is my revenge plot for that. So
what answers did you get for that?
One of them, they said a koala because they like to sleep.
I like that answer.
Yeah.
I kind of always wanted a koala tattoo.
I'm a dog person, so I'd have picked a dog. Man, I don't know. That one's tough just because I don't know that many off the top of my head. If you gave me a list of like, here's all these.
Well, if I got to give you a list and it can't be a favorite if you don't know it.
I guess I feel like the Velociraptors are just kind of mean little assholes that fly around and pick on everybody. So like, I don't know. T-Rex probably just because they're like, you know, they're the head honcho. So
I don't think Velociraptors can fly.
I feel like they can. Is Velociraptors the one that like run around? Pterodactyl. There you go. That's the one. Sorry.
Can you spell it?
No chance. Velociraptors are the little ones that run around. They're still little assholes. They're like too,
many,
probably.
I've always looked at them as mini T-Rexes. Yeah. But pterodactyls are the ones that fly. But I asked that question because there's kind of a running joke. I always ask that question to everybody. And I have a group chat with a bunch of racing friends or whatever. And one of them single or whatever. And he's like, what do I use as my pickup line? And I was like, ask them what their favorite dinosaur is. And we have an Aussie in the group. And he was like, you know, replied, why in the bloody, you know, would you ask a girl what her favorite dinosaur is and all that? And I was like,
cause it makes them think.
Just trust the process.
Yeah. It makes them think.
And I had to explain to him, I was like, when I was in Texas, I was at a bar one night and I asked a bunch of girls, I was like, what's your favorite dinosaur? And they all like laughed at me. And then 15 minutes later they came and found me and they're like, I know what my favorite dinosaur is. And I was like, what is it? And they told me, I looked at my friend and I was like, for 15 minutes,
they
sat there and thought about what their favorite dinosaur was. And I was like, I live rent free. So like I think I'm going to ask every episode what that is. So now everyone after this one's going to know what's coming, but I'm going to ask everybody that. Cause it's such just a wild random question that no one ever thinks about.
Yeah. But I never thought about it.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, I just love that question just in general in life, but, yeah. So I guess, you know, parting shots here, like, do you have anything that you think you want everyone to know that maybe they don't know, or, you know, maybe a message to listeners to kind of, you know, maybe set yourself up for something down the road, or?
Nothing super specific. I mean, obviously there's a lot of people that listen to this thing and a lot of racers and stuff like that. But if there's anybody that's listening to it that wants to come on board as a sponsorship, this is, I guess, a good spot to do that. We've been really working hard for that because Kevin and I really want to do this kind of same thing next year, but add more races to it. So that'd be something. If there is anybody listening that wants to come on board or do something like that and come kind of be a part of our team, that's something. Honestly, I just really want to thank Doc and Rebecca Muthana for the opportunity. It's been a ton of fun. And I feel like it's taken me a long time to kind of get in the right opportunity with the right people around to really show what I'm capable of. Kevin has obviously helped that a lot. I feel like it's taken me that much longer just for the fact that we didn't really come from that much, and everything that we have, we've absolutely busted our tails for. And one thing my dad's always prided me on is just be the hardest working person in the room and you'll have no problem finding success. And I feel like that's finally kind of showed this year. And without it coming across wrong, I genuinely feel like I'm one of the hardest working drivers there is around. But that's just because I feel like I want it that bad. And I've had to work so hard to get here. So why stop now? So I guess, you know, but touching back on that, I really just want to thank them for everything that they've done for me. And I know they haven't been able to come to as many races as they'd like to, but everything that they've done is just so, so appreciated. And I mean, like I said, it opened up a lot of people's eyes to what I feel like my dad has said and seen his whole life. You know what I mean? You just got to get on the right stage and be around the right people. And I feel like it really showed this year.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, we touched positive thoughts lead to positive things, you know, live the dash, you know, outwork, work everybody and all that. So, I mean, I first want to thank you for, you know, coming on. I know.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We've done this here at, you know, TJ's place, you know, 2 weeks in a row, keeping you guys up a little past your bedtime tonight. It's 9:21 as we're finishing up recording. So we did better than we did last week with TJ. So, but yeah, I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate, you know, we'll have some, you know, video stuff here worked up. And we were talking just before the podcast, got a new computer on order. So we'll get to be able to do some cooler stuff there and all that. And then, you know, get this, you know, when this episode releases, we'll get it shared out there and kind of really open up the podcast, I think, to the West Coast crowd. Cause, you know, I think the furthest west we've gone so far to this point would be TJ, Texas, and, you know, Zane, Indiana. So, you know, get out to California, get to a bigger crowd. We grow it and you know, we get, you know, your message and, you know, some of these messages across and really just kind of help grow one, the sport, but then, you know, all the guests that are on it and, you know, down the road, we'll, I think we'll revisit and we'll have another episode, maybe 2 years from now or whatever. And we'll kind of look back and we'll re-listen to this and think, you know, laugh and be like, oh, crazy. That's, you know, where we were at. And, you know, we didn't think we'd be here. And
no, I mean, it's definitely been cool. I mean, I really can't thank everybody else that's been part of my, you know, racing career, all my car owners that I've had over the years back in California and all the opportunities that they've given me. You know, cause I just feel like there's so many drivers compared to cars nowadays that it makes it, I wouldn't say like watered down, but you know, for every one car, there's 10 drivers. So, I mean, it's definitely been a fun ride and I've enjoyed it and, really looking forward to kind of what the future holds.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate you guys all listening in, you know, wherever you are in the world, whether it's, Ohio, Indiana, California, Australia, Europe, Russia, even Antarctica. We appreciate you tuning in and, we'll see you guys next week with another episode.